You're listening to Neurodiversity at Work.
Life can be so shady. The way some people try to bring you down. Why they got to be so crazy? Always trying to give you the run over.
Welcome to today's episode, sponsored and powered by Dynamis Group. Recently honoured to be part of 300 years of leadership and innovation. We at Dynamis believe that business is a catalyst for positive impact in the world by building a bridge between the top leaders of today and the brightest leaders of tomorrow. We inspire them to do things they have never done before. Jamie, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for coming on and joining me today. It is an absolute pleasure having you on the show. This all started with bringing people in the recruitment industry into these conversations so that we could learn more around neurodiversity within that space. However, over the years, it's kind of broadened, but it's really great to get chatting with another recruiter again. Somebody who really understands kind of the employment space, the challenges, the opportunities, and the wonder of neurodiversity at work. So, Jamie, would you like to give our audience an introduction to your wonderful self and the work that you do?
Yes, I think you made it sound a lot more glamorous than it is, but hello, everybody. My name is Jamie. I call myself a registered blind rhino because rhinos are just chubby unicorns with bad eyesight. I am registered blind, I am ADHD, and currently going through my ASD assessment. And you're probably seeing my stretchy unicorns dimming devices flying across the screen. But yes, I work for a global recruitment company, AMS, which provides outsourced recruitment. And then at the side of that, I have my side hustle, which is Disabled by Society, where I come online and rant and support companies with accessibility and their content.
Amazing. And you do a fantastic job, Jamie. We were just chatting before we came live, and I recognise your content. And especially, I don't know when it was, you know, we did the LinkedIn Accelerator program and LinkedIn Creators, which is fantastic, which I think got a lot of people together. So if anybody doesn't know, you can go out and search for LinkedIn creators and you'll find that they're going to that extra level to be able to share their experiences, their ideas, their lived experience. LinkedIn's becoming a really powerful platform actually for people sharing real world experience in the workplace, taking conversations that are happening maybe outside of LinkedIn and bringing them in a way that some other social platforms are not doing, because often you can't hide behind a false name, right? LinkedIn is your self, it's your career, it's your background. So I love the work that you now share and the way that you share it, Jamie, because it is like very much Jamie. I don't think you could mistake it for anyone else. And that is a real skill in itself. So just tell us a little bit about that, Jamie, and a little bit about your experiences and how you've come to get to what you're doing today. A little bit of the background, Jamie.
Yeah, so I'm going to be honest, I always hated anything to do with social media. It was so inaccessible. I'm registered blind, and when you go online and you see images being shared and you can't really engage with them, and you see posts being shared and just filled with emojis and your screen reader is going into like a fit and is trying to read these posts, you just really can't engage with it. So I hated it. And then when I started in AMS, so working in recruitment, they were like, you need to use LinkedIn to find candidates for these jobs. And at first I was really like, this is just for finding people for jobs. I'm just going to do it. And then I kind of started stumbling across different people who were talking about their lived experience of being disabled, of being neurodivergent at work. And I kind of, this thing that went through my brain, I had always kind of struggled with my disability. I was born registered blind. Well, I wasn't born registered blind. I got registered blind when I was young, but I was born with bad eyes, and you know, I didn't know anything different in the world apart from disability, and that I was different, and I didn't really ever really have an outlet to talk about it. You know, my friends and family, they would understand, but nobody really really truly did understand because he didn't have the lived experience. And I'm from Northern Ireland with the accent. I'm so sorry for anybody listening, or if there's subcaptions on this, I'm so sorry.
Love the accent, James. Love the accent. We'll have more of the accent.
So strong. But, you know, I did have an outlet, so I struggled most of my life, and I didn't know I was ADHD. I had no clue. I just thought I was this pretty not understood disabled person, and people thought I was just quirky or I was over the top. And at times I was masking so much that I was almost overcompensating to show that I wasn't disabled and I was just like everybody else. So when I started seeing these posts on LinkedIn, I was like, oh my goodness, I wonder can I do that? I wonder can I write a post about my eyesight? And I remember doing the first post about it, and it was so scary because I was just like, oh my God, what's my employer going to think? What are my friends going to think? And it was almost like working in recruitment gave me this voice, and then LinkedIn became the platform that my voice was used on. So I don't really use any other socials apart from LinkedIn, but it's like, as you said at the start of the call, it's like you can talk, have those conversations that you want to have at work, but you aren't really comfortable. And I think that's what I like about LinkedIn is, it's like you can bring your authentic self, and that's such a buzzword, but on LinkedIn you really can. You can talk about anything to do with your personal life, your work life, and there's that intersectionality as well that you don't get on other social media platforms. So took you down a rabbit hole there, but that is essentially where it kind of started. Started off as ranty and almost like Dear Diary stuff, but it turned into graphics and videos and things like that. But I'm just rambling now.
And how does, Jamie, somebody get into recruitment then? And, you know, what are some of the barriers you faced? And I guess what I find fascinating is how your approach to recruitment might differ to others and how that might in itself be quite impactful for identifying different candidates, bringing different perspectives to the recruitment and assessment process. Sorry, about three questions in one there, but...
No, do not worry. I'll probably answer about six different questions and answer these three. So, you know, when recruitment, I think I stumbled into it, and you'll hear a lot of people who work in recruitment say that. You just stumbled into it. I thought I was going into a sales job, like a call centre job, as that's where my background always was. It wasn't really a background, it was job hopping. I had more jobs and hot dinners. I struggled to retain and gain employment, and I had just left a really big employer I'd been discriminated against, and I'd left in really bad terms. And my friend had posted this job, and I was like, right, it's a call centre, I'm just going to do it. I'll probably be there for training and then drop out after. And lo and behold, it was a recruitment role. And it was strange because I've always wanted to speak to recruiters and kind of say, you're doing this wrong, you need to do X, Y, Z. So it was like I was being at the other side of the table. And slowly over time, I kind of, things weren't always accessible. Things aren't accessible unless you kind of, for myself personally, I have to say this isn't accessible. I need an adjustment, or I need X, Y, Z. I have to disclose when I start employment, and if I don't, I'll just end up leaving. So for me, I came in and told them that I was disabled and I needed adjustments. And it was the first time in, like, I think at this age, I was 27, in my 27 years of life, that an employer actually said, no problem, what do you need? How can we support you? So they completely flipped that narrative that I'd heard was, oh, well, I'm not sure we can get this, or, you know, it might be expensive, or, you know, we don't really hire disabled people. These are things I've heard when I asked for it. So I was like, oh my goodness, I'm now working in recruitment, and it's not the way that I thought it was. And over time, when I was working with my clients, I was saying, you know, I was just saying things to my manager, like, I don't like this because it's not accessible, or I don't like that because, you know, you're limiting candidates here. It was barriers to entry. And my manager started listening, and then the client started listening, and all of a sudden people were listening to what I had to say. And for me, it was very intimidating because, as I said, like, I didn't really speak about my disability. I have a lot of trauma. I think I probably have PTSD with my disability because of I was bullied really badly. I was segregated really badly. I struggled with my mental health. I didn't know I was neurodivergent. So, you know, it was all this kind of baggage underneath and trauma. So I didn't really feel any kind of sense of belonging, and all of a sudden I was feeling belonging in recruitment, the place I always struggled with, and people were listening. So it was very empowering but very intimidating, and that led to me becoming our disability ERG lead. And for anyone who doesn't know, ERG is employee resource group, and essentially it's like a group of colleagues who get to gather and try to create a community and try to really put inclusion and accessibility at the heart of the business. So I joined the disability and neurodiversity ERG and became the lead, and then all of a sudden my role then was created within AMS to support clients with their recruitment and you know, actually making it more accessible, making sure it's more inclusive, because at the moment we have all these companies who are saying, you know, we're so diverse, we're so inclusive, but as soon as you kind of pick up the hood and you look at the application, it's not accessible, or you know, the screen reader can't go through it, or there's no accessible formats, or everything's really neurotypical. It's like things around, oh, are you a good communicator, can you work well as part of a team, you know, these really neurotypical thinking. So it was really strange, because obviously I didn't know I was neurodivergent, but I knew I struggled with certain parts of it. I knew that when I was having interviews, I couldn't keep eye contact. And I used to think it was because of my eyesight, but I was like, how can that be about my eyesight? I can't even see the person, so how can it be because of that? And it was all these little silly things that I thought were to do with my eyesight, but was actually my neurodivergence coming through. And for me, it was very empowering, because that's where I learned that I was neurodivergent, working in the space of identifying barriers for disabled candidates. I realised from going to a session during Neurodiversity Celebration Week two years ago, they were talking and this lady was sharing her lived experiences of acquiring a late diagnosis with her ADHD. And I was sitting there going, just really curious, and I kept inquiring and posting questions into the chat. And I realised at the end of it, I was like, she's talked about me this whole session. Like, everything she says about me. So I kind of put the pieces together. And as I was putting the pieces together, I was able then to kind of tap into my LinkedIn network and kind of get advice around how we can not only think about the accessibility from a disabled point of view, but also for somebody who is neurodivergent, because I know not everybody identifies that way. And I know that there's strengths that we can bring to interview that we are not currently optimizing at the moment, we're not even considering. So I took you down a rabbit hole there and answered so many different ways there. But I think for me, it was feeling empowered to then be able to kind of bring that to my job and use my lived experience to say, well, this isn't right. And then using my ERG colleagues' lived experience as well to say, how do we create awareness, but actually then take real action? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. No rabbit holes there. Well, or enjoyable rabbit holes, depending on how you want to define it. It was a good it was good exploration and journey. So, I mean, it's fascinating, because I think the reality is, for a lot of people that I'm hearing from, they share that experience, the experience of not really understanding what impacts them, both positively and negatively, and how they overlap, and getting sometimes confused around what may be happening. Like you saying, is it my eye contact? Well, it can't be, but you kind of, without the knowledge and understanding of ADHD or autism or dyslexia, then how can you attribute it to something you don't understand or don't know about? So you just attribute it to the rhetoric that you've probably heard at some point, that, you know, if you don't hold good eye contact, that might be that might impact you negatively, right? And maybe it is, maybe that still is an issue, but that's the other person's issue that they need to be educated on, rather than some of the challenges that we face. So what are some of the things at the moment that kind of, frustrate you or get you thinking about individuals, organizations, systems, processes, some of the things that you come across that are actually probably too simple to be overlooked? Do you know what I mean? Like the, at a ground, because I see you write about a lot, Jamie, that, and I have to sometimes think to myself, wow, like, he's right. Am I thinking about those things enough? Do I dismiss or discount them because I'm so focused on the end goal, I'm just like, I'll get there as quickly as I can. But then I'm not being accessible on a basis of rushing to do the things that I want to do. How much of that do you see, and what are the key ones that kind of you would like to see changed or implemented?
Yeah, definitely accessibility. I tell everybody, accessibility is like my buzzword. Like, I'm surprised I don't have a tattoo for somewhere on my body or across my forehead, because I say it at least 7 times a day. And like, you know, for me, it is accessibility. But when you use a screen reader or use assistive technology, or, you know, if you have sight loss or you're deaf or you have a disability that when you're online, it impacts you. And unless somebody understands accessibility, you're going to be left out. You're going to be excluded. I've had that my whole life. And it's only in the past number of years you've actually seen people start to talk about accessibility, which is really exciting, but also really kind of scary, because there's a lot of misinformation out there about it. And I think for me, like, I I think that I don't blame anybody for inaccessibility because we don't know. You know, we are taught at a young age when we're in education to segregate and exclude disabled people. That, you know, if you are different in education, most of us have had experiences where, you know, you've been the problem child, or, you know, this is a negative person because of X, Y, Z. We've all had those experiences. Most of us have had those experiences who are neurodivergent. And when I was disabled, I had the exact same in my eyesight. And I never really knew what accessibility was for myself because the education system didn't teach me, and we don't teach young people how to be inclusive. So this is ingrained in our minds right from early age. So when we're creating content and we're getting into adults, so we're creating content and marketing as business owners, you know, we still don't know because nobody's taught us. And yes, there's information out there online, but not everybody learns that way. And it really frustrated me when I came onto LinkedIn that every second or third post, actually it was every second post, not even third, it was every two posts, I was encountering a barrier. I couldn't read the hashtags. There was too many emojis. I couldn't read the text and the images because of color contrast. And it was just like, it's really frustrating. And I used to get really frustrated at myself, not even the person who posted it, at myself. And I didn't realize that this was, it could have been my ADHD, it could have been this ASD I'm waiting to get diagnosed. You know, I get so angry at myself and it would make me so deflated. Like I would say, oh, you're stupid, you're blind, it's your fault. Look, and that's not a mentality that you should have. And it's probably to do with some internalized ableism and the trauma. But, you know, my brain can't shake this. It's almost like an anger and I'd have to walk away. But I dwell on it all day. So I was on LinkedIn one day and I was like, I'm going to start posting about accessibility because I'm sick of this. And it's everywhere. You know, we see people talk about accessibility and the content itself is not accessible. And I think the biggest shift that we could do is follow people who talk about accessibility. Is, you know, there's courses out there that you could do on LinkedIn Learning. There's, you know, there's all different things. If you want corporate training, come tap me on the shoulder, I'll come do a training with you. If you want individual coaching, there's coaches out there who can help you. Or just look at the content. Like I post everything that I pretty much do with companies, I give away for free in my content. And, you know, if you go through my history of content, pretty much all my work's scattered throughout that. So you can actually get a lot of free tips. But it's, I think that as we kind of move into a space now where we are talking about the celebrating neurodiversity and, you know, we've moved past this acceptance, we're moving towards awareness. It's now about making sure that we're recognizing the intersectionality that comes with being neurodivergent. It's recognizing that, yes, somebody might be neurodivergent, but they also might have bad eyesight. They also might be deaf. They also might have other things that are impacting them. So for me, I think it's about, in this space, there needs to be a shift where we are more conscious about educating ourselves in it. And yes, it is really hard. I agree completely because I didn't know how to do captions and videos. I can't see captions. I've had to go teach myself how to do captions and make sure they're accessible. So it's about upskilling. But I think at the same time, it's making it a bit easier for ourselves. If you are neurodiverse, it's making sure that you have made it a bit easier. You know, I say to people, put it on a mouse mat. You know, get it on a mouse mat. You can get like a checklist. I actually do these checklists and I will be selling these. Shameless plug. But it's like a mouse mat. And on the mouse mat, it tells you, you know, have you added alt text? Have you added closed captions to your video? And it's just a quick reminder. So it's whatever way that you can remind yourself of it. Is pretty much about accessibility, as I'd say. That's the next step. That's what we could do. Because it's disheartening when you're trying to find resources about autism or ADHD and you've got really big names posting about it and you can't engage. And I'm this person who, since I found my voice on LinkedIn, I challenge a lot of inaccessibility and I'll say, this isn't accessible, can you include me? And like, it's really tiring because it paints me out to be this really angry disabled person. I'm like, I'm not angry. I just want to belong. I just want to feel included. I want to know where I can find accessible resources. So for me, accessibility is a big one. And then the second one, I think, is internalized ableism within the space. I think, you know, when we look at neurodiversity in the media or the way it's written about in the press, it's almost like it's this new craze and this new trend. And I look at myself and I look back at my history of not knowing that I was ADHD or ASD. I didn't know. And it's because I was already seen as this disabled kid. I was already different. There couldn't be anything possibly more wrong with me. And I think there's a lot of people out there still who already have disabilities that they were born with, who probably don't even know that they are also neurodivergent because there couldn't possibly be anything more, right? So I think it's about recognizing that there is people out there with that intersectional lived experience, but also recognizing that we all have a place to, you know, at this table. There's a lot of internalized ableism where people give off by people who are self-diagnosed or people who are, you know, who can't really engage and they've asked for accessibility, and it's almost then that person asking, oh, you shouldn't be asking this of an autistic person, or you shouldn't be asking this of a neurodiverse person. You know, it's like, no, why wouldn't we? We want to be included. So for me, that's my two big rants at the moment. Really was a rant, wasn't it?
No, I love that. Loads of really good thoughts and information ideas. So, like, let's bring it down to like a granular level, micro level. If I think about it, I overthink about some of the alt text because I'm not very good at thinking about what I'm seeing, even though I see an image. So I'm very good at picking an image that helps me like connect with an idea, a concept, a story. So I can pick the image and that can make my brain go crazy lots of, or see, that's me using terminology I probably shouldn't. That's me thinking about a huge volume of ideas in an explosion. They just go boom just by one image. However, ask me to take an image and explain what that image is. I feel for anybody who has to read my alt text of images, because they're like, you know, man in red hat with super big jumper sitting in, and I just think, is that enough? Is it good enough? Would you rather I didn't bother
always bother with it. And your alt text is actually good. I like your alt text, by the way. I've heard your alt text of images, so do not worry about that. Do you know what? I think when we see images or we hear something, I think our minds go, doesn't it? Like, I go down rabbit holes with my alt text. Like, I'm sure people read mine and be like, why is he telling me his life story in this image? And then I look at it after, I'm like, I need to edit this really down to like three lines. But like, alt text, it can be as simple and straightforward as you want it to be. And I know that's a really big, loaded statement, because nothing's ever really simple. When you're divergent, your brain goes straight away. But you know, the question that I ask myself is, why am I posting this image? Like, what is the message of it? And if it's like, you know, I'm posting a graphic and I'm trying to represent disabilities and I've used my typical little stick persons, I'll say five stick persons representing both visible and non-visible disabilities. That's all that image is meant to make, to represent there. But if it's something that, you know, is text, if it's a text post or image and text, just put the text. Do not worry about describing it. Alt text is a factual statement with a purpose. What's its purpose? And there is a difference between alt text, so you won't see alt text typically. It gets added into your image, so people won't see it unless they have a screen reader. For anybody who's ever used a screen reader, they are not fun. They are challenging. I use one on and off. Like, I have some vision, it's not the best, but I try to be a bit more without having to rely my screen reader online, so I'll try to use my eyes, even though it's not always the best idea. And I'll have that on the background, but screen readers are hard to use, and not everybody feels comfortable using them. I don't always feel comfortable using it in public. And, you know, especially if I'm late at night walking around, you know, I don't want to draw attention to myself. Imagine me coming along trying to read my documents, sitting at a bus stop. Oh, there goes my selfie light. Blind moment. But, you know, with regards to that, for anyone who didn't see, by the way, that was me kicking my selfie light myself. But with regards to... I completely lost my thought there. Bear with me one second. What was I even saying? Rabbit hole.
Alt text. Yes. The way you put it.
Alt text. So you won't see it with a screen reader. They're hard to use. So what you can do as well is add image description. So alt text is literally just describe the image. What's its purpose? Image description is a little bit more for somebody who doesn't use screen reader. And it's a little bit more in detail. And it'll go into your message body. And it's typically a little bit more detail. You know, what was the person wearing? What is the sex? What are they doing? Again, what's the purpose of the image? So there's a difference. But with alt text, the way that I remember it is, alt text will tell you there's a spill in the floor. Image description will tell you that spill is actually white wine and it's in the middle of the wooden floor.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much. And I think sometimes people just get caught up in the complexity of it in their mind rather than the reality of it not being that complex. And I think this is probably the same if we think about the recruitment process and the assessment process. Or the employee life cycle. We go, neurodiversity or ADHD or accessibility. Right, we need to think about the employee life cycle. No, actually, you probably just need to think about one element to start with, right? And just think, is this bit here, you know, can they get through this door? Okay, no, they can't. Yes. So let's look at the door, because that's the first place they come into the building. And then we can start to work our way. Well, what do you think about that? Is that a good method to kind of start at the beginning and work through, or would you recommend something else?
I love roadmaps. Like I always say, make a roadmap. Start at one thing and you'll try to perfect that thing. We're not going to be, this is especially when it comes to accessibility and inclusion, you're not going to get to magic end overnight. That's not going to happen. Everything has to be thought out and planned. And one thing I always say is, you have the best testers at your fingertips if you're an organisation. You have disabled and neurodivergent colleagues. Why not ask them to get involved? Have them give their voice. They've been through your recruitment process. They can identify straight away where they had particular challenges. And another thing that I always think about is, when you're creating these processes or when you are hiring, it's universal design. Universal design means it's accessible to everybody. You know, if you're posting a job posting, making sure that it's in accessible formats, making sure the language is inclusive, and that's not like, you need to work as part of a team, you also need to work on your own initiative. You know, those kind of statements, I don't think they're very neuro-friendly. I personally don't think they're not very neuro-inclusive. It's like, tell us what you want us to do in that job. Don't give us this in-between waffle, and we want to know what we're coming in to do. So I was thinking about the universal design of it, and having people test it. Like, I agree. It's I always say to everybody, there's no end goal with inclusion or accessibility. It's continuous improvement. You'll not get to an end result. It's just, where are you in this ladder, and how do I maintain or move up where I am?
Brilliant.
I hope that
thank
answered
you.
That.
That's good. Thanks, Jamie. So what would you like to see organisations do more now? What do you think are some of the things that they can consider? What is kind of the... what is the future for neurodiversity? And I guess the thinking around the co-occurrence and, you know, I guess the diversity within neurodiversity. Typically, obviously, it's neurodiversity, right? It's everybody. But what is your view on the journey that we can now make in the next 12 months? Because plenty of awareness, less action, I think, has probably been the reality in where we are.
It's, do you know what, I always tell everybody, D&I, so diversity, equity, inclusion, this whole space within within organisations, people are talking this talk, and you know, people are starting to see through the cracks to realise, you know, actually walking the walk. It's all well and good to be talking about being inclusive and, you know, attending conferences and things like that, or winning awards or whatever you're doing. This is all well and good, but that's not real substantial change. I think the biggest shift that needs to happen is organisations need to move beyond pilots, like that's your pilot hiring pilot. It needs to become your everyday recruitment process, everyday company culture. It needs to be accessible, it needs to be inclusive, and I think that every organization out there needs to create resources within that organization. So what is supporting individuals if they are going through assessments or diagnosis? Because I haven't been through that there very early this year. I got my official diagnosis. I've been self-diagnosed for a year before this. And it was a really important step for me, but it was a very challenging moment for me being in employment, trying to work out my whole life wasn't what I thought it was. It was like unraveling away from me. And so I think it's about providing space that you can support colleagues as they go through that, but making sure that you're doing it in an accessible way, because a lot of the times the stuff to do with your diversity, it's not accessible. A lot of this content isn't accessible, or the resources or even the trainings that's been delivered, they're not accessible. So it's about recognizing that intersectionality, but also recognizing that, you know, if we look at neurodiversity in the communities, you know, black, brown people, people who are indigenous, people from marginalized groups are not getting the same support or access to treatment. So it's about making sure that you as a workplace are creating that space where everybody is getting an equal and equitable experience, where if you can, please support people getting their diagnosis. It's such a hard journey to go through, especially if you've gone through it alone or you have financial restraints or you're not offered the privilege to be able to go private. So it's creating that space. And I think it's also about recognising, you know, we talk about awareness all the time. Everything's always awareness, and it's really good to continue that awareness, but action is what we need to see. And I think it's about making sure that there is representation of autistic leaders, of neurodiverse leaders, of recognising the value at leadership level, rather than talking about disability and neurodiversity in the CEO boardroom, have somebody in there who is disabled, who is neurodiverse. And I know there is companies out there who's trying to do schemes around mentoring, like the Valuable 500. They're doing the Gen V at the moment, which is training up the next C-suite leaders of disabled people, which is all fantastic. But again, that's not putting somebody on that level now. This is future leaders. This is down the line. And I think what we need to do is really have a focus on that representation, but also looking at how we are developing and upskilling and promoting our colleagues internally, because representation matters. We all know it does. And when you're looking at a typical promotion, so moving from one role to another, there is questions in there again that are so neurotypical. If it's not designed, the world's not designed for neurodiverse people. It's a neurotypical world, so it's looking at how we can change the language. How can we make that more inclusive? How can we make it again more accessible? Because accessible isn't just your content or access to your buildings. It's making sure the language is correct. It's making sure your response is accessible and that it's inclusive. So for me, there's a lot of different things, but if you don't know where to start, start point A, start your roadmap. Where am I today? Where do I want to be in 12 months? And be realistic. You're not going to have, not every organization is going to throw loads of money at this. We want them to. We really, really want them to. But not every organization is at that stage where they're willing to. So it's recognizing, what can we do this year? What can we do to show that there is impact to this business, that there is value in doing this here, and that by doing this here, we are not only going to attract more talent, but we're going to make sure that we're retaining it. Because we're not retaining talent at the moment. We're bringing people in who are getting into cultures that aren't accessible, that aren't inclusive, where they have talks around neurodiversity or disability, and the language even being used, it's completely ableist. You know, person with autism, no, it's an autistic person. You know, it's changing that language, and I think that's where the biggest change is. It's a culture change internally, and I think that we've had these smoke screens up for the past few years, and I think now it's time we suck the smoke out of the air, because we're starting to see through. And even the marketing, like, if you've seen how companies market neurodiversity, there's no real representation. Like, I don't see images of people in the workplace with stimming devices. Like, I go on to meetings, I call these like stretchy things, I love them, but these are my stimming devices. These help me focus, these help me feel that, I don't even know how to explain it. It's like my powers went into these, and it's almost like it's helping me stay in the room. We don't see that in representation. So I think it's about really looking at how you are representing this here, and you'll get that culture shift as well.
Absolutely.
That was a rabbit hole again.
I love the roadmap. I love the roadmap thing, and it's something I really appreciate and buy into. And you think about that journey. That roadmap doesn't just have to exist for a customer, an organization, but actually an individual. Because what you've just talked about is late diagnosis, the choice around diagnosis, that journey being difficult, and then the realization of what that means. And interestingly, maybe, I don't know, a lot of people will have some expectation that with the diagnosis comes additional support. Often, that additional support doesn't exist, or it may be another list to sit and wait for somebody to offer you one drug or another, which may or may not be something that you want to explore as well. So I think there's a lot of misunderstanding around what the long wait or the private consultation will get you.
And you know what? I've told everybody since my diagnosis, I thought I was going to get this diagnosis because I was self-diagnosed for a year. I thought I'd accepted that I was neurodivergent. But when I got told that I was ADHD combined and that I had to go for an ASD assessment, it was like I didn't know myself at all. It was like, I tell everybody, it was like, do you pass the parcel? You pass the parcel. That's what you do. You're going to ripping apart parts of your past experiences, and you replay, it's like a replay in memory of everything that's ever happened, and you're like, was that because of this? Was that because of XYZ? My partner went through the diagnosis stage at the same time as me, and I will say I'm very happy I went for mine. Yes, it's opened up a whole can of worms, but I'm learning how to reframe that and learn, do you know what? Yes, I did miss out, but you know what? Look where I am today. Everything that's happened has led me where to I am today. Whereas, and I'm learning what kind of coping strategies work for me. But my partner, on the other hand, he is you know, still very much going, I don't know if that was the best choice for me. He was diagnosed with ASD and ADHD as well. Explains so much in our household, by the way. Explains so much. The two of us didn't know all along. But, you know, it's, I look at that and I hear other people say, oh, I wish I wouldn't have went for it. And a big thing for me is self-diagnosis is such an important first step. And I know there's people who out there who look down on it and say, oh, you shouldn't self-diagnose. We know our brains better than anybody else. We know if we have researched, and let's be honest, when you go to research, or am I ADHD, am I autistic, that's hyper-focus. Like, you spend hours, days, weeks, months just really going through the same things and breaking it down and really trying to put your whole life into that, there, what you think this is. So I think that is such an important stage, and I think that recognizing self-diagnosing, we need to kind of support individuals more with that there and recognise the value of it, because if I hadn't self-diagnosed a year ago today, I probably wouldn't be in my job, because once I started self-diagnosing, I felt comfortable to say, do you know what, can you send me meetings after, follow-up notes after this meeting of what we've discussed, because I am ADHD and I want to make sure I've got everything on point. And that little change, or being able to communicate a little bit differently or asking to be communicated, that's had such a profound impact on my work. You know, I was on a call earlier today and I said, I'm just going to turn off my camera. I've had meetings all morning and I'm feeling a little bit overload right now. And it was just completely accepted. And I'm like, that's what belonging is. That's what inclusion is. It's being able to say, I need to do this here for me. And nobody question it. Nobody say, well, why is he turning his camera off? Or that's not fair. That's not a fair playing field. No, it's, we need to recognise that we all are different and work, learn, think differently.
Also, I think there's the, it's empowering others to be able to start to represent and to say, I was on a call where somebody, the senior manager, didn't mean anything negative, but he was like, oh, he was naming the person saying, oh, switch your camera on. And they were like, oh, okay, yeah, I'll try. And I said, no. Don't tell him to switch your camera on. Don't worry about it. You don't need to switch your camera on. And because I heard the hesitation in their voice. Now, it may be that the room was a bit messy. It may be that they were traveling. It may, right? There could be a thousand reasons. We don't need to know any of those reasons. But the person saying switch your camera on thought they were doing the right thing for me being there to say, Theo's not met you before. Let him meet you. I'm like, I can meet them without seeing them. You know, and I
get it all the time.
And so I think you make some great points about the self-diagnosis, self-advocacy, advocacy of others. We don't need a label to do that, right? We don't need a label to stand by our principles and stand up for what we believe in and stand up for the values that we believe in and the values of others. I think the minute we start to put barriers in place is the minute we don't allow the voices to stand up and say, actually, why are we doing it this way? Because we don't give the permission. It's like my wife is not, well, she may, who knows, right? But she's not associated necessarily with a neurodivergent brain at the moment, right? So let's just say for the argument's sake, she's not, right? She still has to advocate for me, my daughter, our family. She still goes through a lot of experiences that maybe if you want to define it, a neurotypical person may not have to go through. She is still going from him. She's not got a label or a badge, but she still wants to champion my autistic and ADHD daughter or a autistic and ADHD husband, depending on the situation. And like, I'm big on that, Jamie, and I love the work that you do and challenging the status quo and pushing the boundaries and continue doing what you're doing. I know sometimes there's negativity, there's people who push back, there's people of differing views. But ultimately, stay the course, because we need different views and opinions, and we need the ability for those opinions to come together and clash and so that we can make sense of them. So, Jamie, where can people find you? You've got LinkedIn Live sessions now. I was involved in one the other day. You've got all types of content going out. You share tons on LinkedIn. You talk about free resources. You educate me on a weekly, daily basis. Because I create content and I find it very insightful and engaging. If people want to connect with you, work with you, find you, where do they go in, Jamie?
Yeah, on LinkedIn, come to my LinkedIn, honestly, that's where everything is. Like, I do have Twitter, but like, I don't really use it, to be honest with you. Like, I generally keep forgetting to have it. I need to delete it because, sorry, Swatter. I need to delete my Twitter because it's not accessible. And you're just going to call for apologies. I have a sore throat from last week, from being in London, actually. I've come home with a sore throat, the joys of travelling. But if you want to connect with me, LinkedIn, get me on LinkedIn. If you want to work with me, if you want me to come into accessibility training, I have my own side hustle, as I said, Disabled by Society. I'm about to start my own podcast again. I've had two in the past and I've stopped them after a while, but I'm now doing it with Laura Mathias and Celia Hensman. So we're doing something called Doing It Differently. We all have different lived experiences and we're coming together to kind of rant, laugh, joke and try to find a way. But yeah, that's just, LinkedIn. Find me on LinkedIn and come say hello. Don't be a stranger.
Brilliant. Go find Jamie Thank you, Jamie, for sharing your experiences and all the great work that you do. So pleased to get you on. And continue doing what you're doing. Keep going.
Thank you so much. And I'm so sorry for we are down so many rabbit holes. It's like Alice in Wonderland.
We gotta do it. When you get two ADHDers in a room, like, if we're not going down a few rabbit holes, what are we doing? That's the fun.
Not doing it right.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Jamie.
You've been listening to Neurodiversity, eliminating kryptonite, enabling superheroes. Hope you enjoyed the show. You can like, share, comment, find us anywhere on any good podcasting host. You can also do some further reading up and buy my book, co-authored with Professor Amanda Kirby, Neurodiversity at Work. You can get it on Amazon with Kogan Page, our publisher, and pretty much any other good bookstore. Enjoy. Look forward to your feedback and keep listening to the show. Thank you.